Welcome to Alternative Realities, a podcast about the people, strategies, and stories driving the world of alternative investments. I'm Aaron Mulvihill, and I will be joined today by Ashmi Mehrotra, Global Co-Head of JP Morgan Asset Management's Private Equity Group, and Jeremy Beal, Head of Products and Advisory Solutions for Morgan Stanley Wealth Management. Ashmi and Jeremy both have extensive experience in the alternative industry and have observed the significant growth of the use of alternatives in investment portfolios over the past couple of decades. On today's episode, we'll be discussing the broadening out of alternative investments to a wider pool of investors, as well as the current dynamics within private equity and its role in investor portfolios. Let's get started. Jeremy, Ashmi, welcome to Alternative Realities.
Great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
Jeremy, I'll start with you. You started in Morgan Stanley back in 2002, and you've actually been involved in the alternative industry since that time. Can you talk a little bit about your career, what brought you to your position today, and how you've seen the industry evolve over that time?
Yeah, sure, Aaron. Again, thanks so much for having us on the podcast. To your point, I joined Morgan Stanley actually right out of grad school in 2002, and got incredibly fortunate to be hired into their commodity pool managed futures business at the time, which is really their version of alternative investments. And so I sort of grew up in that business, and it's been an incredible journey. It's fun too to look at going forward how much more I think the industry is going to evolve, particularly in this space. I feel like I've been doing this for 23 years, but still sort of on the precipice of a lot of change in front of us. But if I look back on, you know, alternatives at the time, I mean, the reality was it was very limited to investors. It was primarily institutions, ultra high net worth, wealthy clients that had access to this, you know, very mystique, you know, special place with not a ton of transparency. Mm-hmm. So when you think about, you know, maybe the individual investor, there wasn't a ton of choice. Minimum investments into the asset class were extremely high or prohibitive to be able to even get into the asset class. The fee structures, I would say, had not evolved and, you know, were higher than needed. The investment process to actually invest in the asset class was very cumbersome. And I can remember being, you know, on the product and operations team at the time. And there were times where I was even packing, you know, offering documents inside of a FedEx box to be able to send to our advisors and our clients to sign. So it was a very clunky business at the time. I'd say performance reporting wasn't super transparent, wasn't very sophisticated, you know, there's already a lag to the asset class, but it was significantly lagged. Mm. Fast forward today. And again, it's been a fun journey to be a part of it and to see this business grow. In particular though, to be able to give access, I think, to individual clients who really deserve access. And they just didn't have the structure or the ability to be able to get into the asset class before. So, you know, fast forward to today, access has improved dramatically. You know, on a platform like ours, there's a couple hundred offerings across private equity, private credit, private real estate, real assets, hedge funds, so on and so forth. The minimums have come down. I think the fee structures are much more efficient and responsible. I think the ability to invest, or I'd say the experience, has become much more digitized versus on paper. So the ability to, you know, e-sign documents and still be delivered your offering memorandums to read through the risks associated with the investment. It's just a much better experience. Same thing with performance reporting, you know, valuations. I feel like the timing has picked up and there's greater transparency and speed to the clients there. So, you know, again, it's been an amazing journey the last 23 years, seeing where it went to where it is today, but recognizing there's still a tremendous, I think, runway ahead of all of us to continue to deliver this asset class to our client base.
Yeah, yeah, it seems like we're only getting started in some respects when it comes to expanding into the private wealth space. And Ashmi, let me bring you in on this conversation on private equity specifically, where you're focused. How have you seen the industry evolve over time?
Great. Well, thanks, Aaron. And thanks for having me. So yeah, really kind of similar to what Jeremy was saying, I've been in the industry for 26 years. So over the last 26 years, private equity more specifically, it's changed dramatically. I mean, in the early 2000s, it was really a smaller industry. If you can look at the kind of AUM of the private equity industry at that time, it was less than $1 trillion. And now private equity, if you look at the stats today, you know, estimates are anywhere between $8 and $13 trillion, right? And so there's been a lot of expansion in our market. It was much more a smaller, niche-y cottage industry 20 plus years ago. And if we look at different factors even within that, right, I can kind of go through a few more in terms of even number of funds, number of firms that are private equity, that are doing private equity deals. Way back when was like 75 or 80 funds would get raised 20 years ago, right? Like in any given year. Now it's thousands of funds get raised every single year. Like last year, it's estimated that nearly 2,000 funds got raised. By the way, there's 10,000 funds that are looking to get raised, to get capital raised now. So there's tens of thousands of firms that are actively investing in private equity today versus really like less than even 100 or 200 that were active 20 years ago. The other thing that's changed dramatically in our market in private equity is really the rise of private credit, because a lot of the LBOs obviously are done with leverage, and the financing markets, you know, really post GFC is when you saw the rise of this new asset class, even called private credit, right? And that's grown to over $1 trillion, $2 trillion in terms of that overall size. And so that obviously plays an important role in private equity as well. The other thing I would say is on the secondary market, when I started in this business, when you were selling private equity stakes on the secondary market, it was much more, well, there's a distressed situation. There's something fundamentally that's gone wrong with, you know, whoever's selling it in terms of their strategy, whatever it may be. And you were seeing very, very few transactions that would happen on an annual basis, like really less than even $5 or $10 billion of activity in any given year. And now, you know, we're going to have an active market this year, and it's going to be the highest in terms of peak transaction volume at over $200 billion. And it's really a tool in the toolkit now used by buyers and sellers to access secondaries or sell stakes in different positions that they have, as opposed to, well, I'm in a liquidity crisis or I have a distress situation. So that's changed dramatically too. And then lastly, I would say exactly to what Jeremy's point was, like, there's a lot more selection. There's a lot more strategies to select from, not just in private markets and alts, but also just even within private equity. There's buyout, there's growth equity. There's obviously venture capital, there's growth stage venture. Like, there's a lot of different strategies and specializations that continues to provide investors with a lot of selection.
And Jeremy, widening the scope now to the broader alternatives universe, we hear a lot about this idea of the democratization of alternatives. What does that mean to you? And what does it take to make this successful?
Yeah, look, I think simply put, it means more investors having access to the asset class, right? just very simply put. And maybe to play a little bit off of what Ashmi said too, just around choice. Again, we're in a privileged position at Morgan Stanley to be able to have a tremendous amount of choice and a tremendous number of asset manager partnerships to, you know, the opportunity to put these solutions on to the platform. But with that, I think comes an incredible responsibility. The flip side of that is manager selection becomes incredibly important, right? Because now the velocity of opportunities that you have coming at you with very similar strategies across the board is incumbent upon us to be able to select what we think are sort of the best strategies for our client base. So manager selection, I think, is a really important part or important ingredient in terms of the success of the asset class overall and those investments for the clients. When we talk about democratizing the space, I mean, it really means as you widen that aperture, you're taking institutional quality investments. You're typically putting them in open-end structures with some type of liquidity feature at lower minimum investments, with responsible fee structures. And so I think one of the critical ingredients there is ensuring that whatever strategy you're putting into a solution or a wrapper for a client, that there's a responsible match in terms of, you know, liquidity and a lack of liquidity, and then a responsible match around education and proliferating that message out to those clients and helping them understand exactly what they're invested in and exactly what they're not invested in, right? So it's still an illiquid asset class. It still requires a level of, you know, I think knowledge and sophistication on both the part of the financial advisor and the client, understanding kind of where it fits inside of their portfolio to help them achieve their goals. So, you know, again, go back on what's the wrapper look like? Does the strategy fit inside the wrapper? Is there responsible matching there in terms of liquidity? Is there sufficient education around it and distribution, you know, being in front of advisors and clients and helping them understand what they're invested in? And then I think, and we'll talk a little bit more about this later, but as the asset class continues to evolve, you know, one would hope that you've got, you know, more asset allocation, model portfolio frameworks for clients to invest in, making it easier for them to digest the asset class. I do think those democratized vehicles will spend or will play a really key role in that, in the ability to have the optionality around rebalancing portfolios in sort of the traditional sense. And like I said, we'll probably spend a little bit more time on that later, but I think that's a that's an important byproduct of the democratization of the asset class.
Yeah, I do want to get back to this access question and how you have those conversations. But first, Ashmi, turning back to you, with private equity being the first asset class that a lot of investors think about when they talk about alternatives, can you help us understand where does private equity fit in a client portfolio? And what are some of the risks that investors should weigh in evaluating whether they should add private equity to a portfolio?
Great. Yeah. So really, there's three main reasons to do private equity. The first is alpha generation. Private equity, usually we target 300 to 500 basis points of alpha versus a, you know, public market equivalent. So that's the, really the first reason. And over time, strong, you know, alpha has been generated as part of our asset class. That's the first reason. So return enhancement. The second is increased equity diversification. As we know, increasingly so, companies are staying private longer. The IPO market, although it's improved in the recent months, is still relatively weak compared to, you know, where we were many, many years ago. And so I'll give you a stat of the companies in the US that have $100 million of revenue or more, 85% of them are actually privately held. And so increasingly so in the public markets, it's a narrower kind of subset. And in the private markets actually is a much wider subset. So we think it merits, you know, portfolio allocation in order to get increased equity diversification. So that's really the second reason.
Yeah, and the third reason, that stat, by the way. We actually added that chart this quarter to the guide to alternatives because it's such a powerful stat on why you need exposure to this space, because a lot of the companies that form the US economy are in private equity today.
Yeah, and I love the new guide to alts, by the way. I think it's the best one yet.
Thank you. I'll pass it on to the team.
And then the third reason is lower volatility. So, you know, the like funds and companies are usually marked monthly or quarterly. And so it tends to be a smoother kind of experience for investors. And so there tends to be lower volatility in private equity as well. But there's always risks with every investment, every asset class. And the risks include kind of what Jeremy was talking about on the liquidity. Private equity is an illiquid asset class. By the way, venture capital is probably the most illiquid asset class. So it's not even the funds that are evergreen or perpetual. They are not liquid vehicles. It is definitely an illiquid asset class, but hopefully over time you're doing it because you want to enjoy that return enhancement that you get from the private markets over a long period of time. The other risk is, again, to Jeremy's point, manager selection and asset selection is critical. Mm-hmm. So access due diligence is critical, and having networks in terms of how to actually diligence and get information that's not publicly available on different things you're looking at is critical. And by the way, that's even more critical in private equity because the dispersion between top and bottom quartile is so large. It's one of the largest across any asset class. It's over 20%. So you would do it to enjoy the returns, hopefully, in the lower vol, but you have to be very, very focused on manager selection and asset selection.
Yeah. So choose wisely is the message.
Trying to make sense of investing in alternatives? Our guide to alternatives is designed to simplify the complex world of alternative investments and to help you make more informed decisions. For more information on the guide, visit our website at jpmorgan.com/GTA.
If we look at private equity, there's different obviously sectors of private equity, a lot of strategies out there. I'd like to dig a little bit more into the small to middle market segment of private equity.
Hey, Aaron, could I jump into just to,
please.
I just want to reinforce Ashmi's point on manager selection, what I was saying earlier, just to give you a sense of the number of opportunities. You know, we're privileged enough to see coming into the asset management community, we'll put less than 10% of those onto the platform and make those available for client investment. So you think about the tightness of the funnel at the bottom and the level of work and due diligence review that goes into that process. Manager selection really does become, you know, a key element, I think, for success for the ultimate client that invests.
Yeah, absolutely critical.
Maybe I'll add, sorry, just a minor point to that too, is that we have a large team of 70 people, but a lot of the work that we do on the investment side is to really try to uncover the things that, you know, are not readily available, like in the pitch deck, that's going to look really good. Like what are the things that we're trying to uncover about the manager or the asset from our networks in particular, to try to uncover, like, because not every story is going to be obviously good. There's things about risk in every single investment. And so it's our job to uncover what the things are that we should know about for these people or assets through our network. And then how do we then make a risk return assessment at the end of the day, right? But we have to gather as much intelligence during our due diligence process. And that a lot of times can take years. Like, we're tracking managers for years before we make that first investment.
Exactly.
Yeah, I love that you both had things to add on that, because that's a big part of both of your roles, whether it's sifting through the strategies that are out there or sifting through the companies that are out there to acquire and partner with. It's absolutely critical in terms of being successful in private equity investment. And Ashmi, on the small and mid cap space particularly, I'd like to kind of distinguish that from the mega cap of private equity that gets a lot of headlines. Is it fair to say that private equity is the new small cap? I've seen that kind of headline bandied around. How do you view this and the small to mid cap space within private equity particularly?
Yeah, so we've been investing in private equity for 45 years. And I talked about how large the market has become, you know, $13 trillion or so. We focus mainly on the small and mid-size companies and funds, which can be quite complementary to the large end of the market. And there's a few reasons why we do that. So the first reason is I talked about the expanding private market companies in terms of the overall set of equity that you can invest in. If you look at the smaller companies, not just those that have $100 million of revenue or higher, which are 85% of the market, If you look at even smaller companies, because we invest in smaller companies even than that, it's 2.6 million potential companies in US and Europe alone that is our potential base for us to invest into. And by the way, like I said, that base is actually growing, not shrinking at the end of the day. So we like that opportunity set. The other thing that's interesting is that there's a lot, there's other attractive attributes of how we end up investing in the companies, usually at a lower entry multiple. There's also a lot more potential for operational improvements in those companies. There's usually the first institutional investor coming into those family-owned businesses that are great little leaders in their niche geography or niche sectors, but they are ripe for sort of the private equity toolkit in terms of value add that PE can provide. Professionalization, systems, sales and distribution, marketing, supply chain, doing add-on acquisitions. And they're at sort of that inflection point of when some of these value-added tools in the toolkit can be especially applicable. And then we don't also employ a lot of leverage on these companies. They're on average less than 4.5 times debt to EBITDA. Another reason why we like the small. But then also, very importantly, and this is a very important subject even for today, where a lot of LPs in private equity have not really, you know, had a lot of distribution activity back, meaning they haven't got a lot of realizations back from their PE portfolios. The small and mid space tends to be a little more consistent because we're not waiting for an IPO market for these companies to get exited. It's usually through strategics or to other private equity firms. So the small mid can be quite additive and complementary, not just to what you were saying on the small cap potential, portfolio on the listed side, but also on the private equity side.
And Jeremy, turning back to you, how do you determine which alternative investment is suitable for clients? How do you have that conversation?
Look, it begins and ends with the client. The reality is we have clients coming from all different positions, and you have to ask them, what are their goals? What's their time horizon? What's their risk tolerance? So, you know, part of our job, this goes a little bit back to, you know, the manager selection process, but part of our job is to curate a menu of alternative investments that's going to fit the need of all of those clients, whether they're, you know, an institutional client or individual client or a high net worth client or, you know, whatever, wherever they're coming from, family office, OCIO client. All the things that we do sort of start with curating the highest quality menu possible for those types of clients. And then it starts and ends with their goals and what they need. And then reliance on our financial advisors at that point, and obviously a lot of education that, you know, whether it's our team or Ashmi and, you know, the balance of the other teams in this, in, you know, in the asset management community, educating them on how to pick and choose those alternative investments to fit the client needs. You know, comes right back to the client's individual goals. But I think it's important to note that you've got, you know, not all clients are created equal. Their goals aren't always the same. And therefore, you've got to have a robust enough, you know, quality menu to be able to achieve all of their goals, no matter what those are.
Yeah. And on that point, not all investment vehicles are the same.
Exactly.
And so, Ashmi, I'd like to turn to you for this one, particularly in private equity. You've got drawdown funds, sort of maybe the older structure, evergreens, a newer, more accessible structure. Are drawdowns out completely? How do you view one versus the other today?
A great question. So drawdowns are certainly not over or kind of yesterday's news. Drawdowns are still in PE 95%+ of the market in terms of capital raise in any given year. Certainly evergreens are growing and growing, you know, significantly, but they're still, you know, 5%+ of the market. And so we like to think of not them as sort of one or the other, but rather it depends on the investor and what their objective is. Kind of going back to what Jeremy was saying, we increasingly see clients, all different types of clients, use both actually together or use one or the other, really depending on what their ultimate objective is. And so we've seen individual investors now, because they have access that they like through the evergreen funds. They are more simplified solutions and structures to be able to access, meaning, you know, tax reporting, more transparency, no capital calls. There's a potential for liquidity, as Jeremy was talking about, although they are not liquid funds. And so there are different aspects of it that sort of can take away some of the sometimes friction for some investors relative to a drawdown vehicle. But on the other hand, investors still like the drawdown vehicles to be able to access specific strategies that may not be available in an evergreen fashion or structure. And so we're increasingly seeing within our own client base, clients very comfortable using both, right? Because there's different specializations and different strategies relative to what they are looking to accomplish. And it ultimately comes down to what's the type of investor, and then what is the investor's ultimate objective? And then it comes also down to being very focused on awareness and education around, regardless of what vehicle it is, it's still an illiquid asset class. That's what you're getting into in private equity. And there's pluses and minuses in terms of how you curate your overall allocation, whether it's to drawdown or evergreen. And again, in many cases, multiple drawdowns in your portfolio and multiple evergreens in your portfolio. And that's where the industry continues to go.
And Jeremy, I'd like to wrap it up with you in terms of the big picture of portfolio allocation. So for a long time, investors have become accustomed to the traditional 60-40 portfolio, as we call it, 60% equity, 40% fixed income. But with the rise of alternative assets, investors and advisors are starting to rethink that. So looking ahead, how do you think about this? Do we move towards a 50-30-20 type allocation, or is there something else you expect in terms of the standard portfolio allocation going forward?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I think you've already started to see a shift, and I've noticed this in conversations with, you know, clients and advisors. So, you know, maybe historically at the institutional level, you've got some institutions that are 50% allocated to the space, others are 30%. You know, clearly our, you know, collective investment committees put out guidance, you know, somewhere between 10 and 30% call it, but the conversation with the advisor and client has changed significantly. And I actually think it's migrated back towards the 60-40 discussion, but with the intellectual acknowledgement, you know, and Ashby said it perfectly earlier, companies are staying private longer. Private credit, there's a phenomenal amount of opportunity, and you've seen a huge amount of scale come to the industry there. So I actually think the conversation shifted towards, okay, you've got your traditional 60-40 portfolio. How can I now incorporate and complement private investments into that traditional 60-40 split? And I think intellectually it's made it a little bit easier for clients to understand in that traditional framework rather than feel like they're treating alternatives as almost a separate asset class. And I think, you know, if adoption is an indicator and, you know, kind of what we've seen happen in the space over the last few years, then I think it's a consistent message that's actually really helped the growth of adoption in our system. And just looking, you know, ahead, I think model portfolios are going to be really important as we get more granular around the asset allocation framework and incorporating alternatives and privates into existing models. I think that those open-end funds, and Ashby said it perfectly earlier too, like we believe in both drawdowns and evergreens, depends on the client's objectives, their goals, and what they actually need. I'd also throw in with the evergreens, you do theoretically get some vintage year diversification because it can be hard for an individual investor, for instance, to deploy capital in a disciplined way over multiple vintages. But regardless, I think those democratized vehicles actually play a really critical role in getting, you know, model portfolios allocated to alternatives and privates over time, given they can, you know, have the optionality around liquidity if liquidity is actually there.
Yeah, and I really like that framework you outlined that's more of a spectrum across public and private, but you can still keep that sort of 60-40 framework in your mind as you're allocating.
Yep.
Well, Jeremy, Ashmi, thank you very much for joining us today on Alternative Realities.
Thanks for having us. This is great. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by J.P. Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.